Hello and welcome to Tacona Talks, a podcast where I sit down with interesting people from within the automotive world and we learn more about who they are and what they do. The idea behind the podcast is that we set an example around conversation in the hopes that we encourage a few more people to talk more. If I can do it with people from within the industry and with people that I've met through cars, then maybe you can do it with your friends. I've hit record, so that's it. We're going.
Nice
and easy. So yeah, let's chat about cars and you and what you do. The only question, as always, who are you and what do you do?
My name's Anton Ingram. I'm a freelance motoring writer, and I guess these days, being freelance, I don't just write, but I do sub-editing, and I write books, and I do driving for people, and probably lots of other things that I'm forgetting.
It's quite a varied role then now. It's not the days of yore where it's like, I'm a writer and I write things and that's it.
Yeah, it's these days, I guess, I mean, it depends who you are and what your reputation's like and all that kind of thing, but it's kind of an any port in a storm sort of thing these days. So if I can do work and it's vaguely within my area of expertise, then I will
usually You're a happy chap.
Yeah.
Which is, so I've relatively recently kind of dipped a toe into that world, shall we say. So I've started doing a quarterly piece with Redline magazine.
Right, yep.
And obviously I keep up to date on what the news page on the Tacona site and doing little bits of video-y bits here and there and kind of going, oh, this car journalism thing looks quite interesting. And then I spend more time chatting to the likes of like you and Alex Goy and Stephen Dobie and people that do it properly. It's like, yeah, you got to spin so many plates. I'm like, oh god, this is really ruining the dream of being a motoring journalist part-time, because there is no way to do it proficiently part-time, because you have to build that network in a quite a substantial way to get that reputation, I suppose.
Yeah, and it kind of depends on the job as well. Like, some are more time intensive than others, so I imagine it's possible to do it as a kind of a part-time thing. But I find a good proportion of what I do is actually looking for work in the first place, which that obviously takes time as well.
So do you spend a lot of time kind of trying to find the stories to talk about? And that, like, is the process for you find something interesting to either talk about or write about or film or drive, and then proposing that to the right outlet? Or do you find it's the other way around and they tend to be looking for something and you go, oh, I can fill that gap for you?
There's a bit of both. I mean, I'm quite lucky that most of my clients kind of know what I'm good at already, and they know what kind of things I'm the right person to do. I do have I think probably all freelance journalists have a big list of things they would love to do. Actually turning that list into reality isn't the easiest of things, but I mean, I would love to say that I spend my days in a coffee shop coming up with amazing story ideas and stuff, but actually most of what I do is kind of stuff that most people, most I would say car enthusiasts, probably don't really see. It's not the big cool features for Evo or something. It's behind the scenes stuff on people's car websites. And those really are the ones that pay the bills, and if I can do the cool fun stuff,
it's like a nice cherry on the top.
I
can't remember who was telling me, but they were doing some writing for a manufacturer, and he was like, no one's ever going to see this. It's all stuff that stays internal and is relevant to like internal communications, but it needs to be done properly. So they need someone that has the right set of skills to write properly and convey a message appropriately.
Yeah.
And then that's when they reach out to independents to do stuff. And it's like, I didn't even think about that. You just assume that there's someone within a department somewhere that writes everything that goes out, and they're like, no, they pay different people to do different things when it's different messages and stuff like that.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, there are obviously journalists out there who pretty much only ever do the big cool features. Yeah. But I imagine most people probably have the cool stuff is like a bit on the side, and do something slightly more boring, less high profile as the kind of day to day. But which is, it's kind of a nice way to do things, because I, in some ways, it makes the fun things even more special. But also, the fun things are very time intensive.
Yeah.
Like writing a big feature is usually the work of several days. And ultimately, you can only squeeze those several days so many times into a month.
Yeah.
So doing the other stuff is kind of just, that's the day-to-day sitting at a desk writing type stuff.
Yeah, you're really ruining this for me. I'm really, really disappointed that it's not all driving supercars sideways and then just going, I drove a supercar sideways.
Well, some of it is, and that's the stuff you put on Instagram
and
Twitter and stuff.
So. That's how you get people like me hooked. You go, oh, look how cool this was. Oh my God, that sounds amazing. And then you actually sit down and go, yeah, I also spent 3 weeks sat writing brochured features and stuff like that. Like,
yeah.
Oh yeah, I forgot that that's also a part of this world. Which I guess puts me in a reasonably fortunate position that my day-to-day is not the stuff that I would immediately kind of struggle to keep attention with. Mm. As I've mentioned a few times in various places, I'm on this waiting list for an ADHD assessment. And the more I spend time learning about it and relaying it back, the more I'm like, yeah, I could find how quickly I would tolerate something like that. And then as soon as I had to do it twice, I'd be like, I want to do something else.
Yeah,
and it takes a different kind of personality to what I have to be able to do the less shout about stuff. Mm. Basically, my brain is addicted to dopamine.
Yeah,
and the only way to get more of it is to do more and more like big, loud, dangerous, exciting things.
Yeah,
because as soon as you do one thing more than once, it doesn't give you the same kind of buzz. So then your brain's like, oh, I don't want to do this anymore, and you become like allergic to being bored. So it's like absolute hell. Like the 20 minutes between like making my breakfast and you getting here, I was kind of just wandering around the house like, oh, I can't do anything because I've not got enough time because I have a incredibly poor time management skills. So I managed to get the Renault Sawn. It took me 5 minutes and it should have been a 5 minute job. And I'd spent 20 minutes of 10 minutes bouncing around, 5 minutes actually doing the thing. And then 5 minutes being proud of myself for getting an administrative task done that's only taken me a year. But I can imagine that the days where you have to sit down and get kind of a long slog of writing done for something that isn't an exciting project, you have to get yourself into a certain kind of mind frame to do that.
Yeah, and I think I've become better at doing that over the years as well.
Yeah.
When I was at university, I would say I was incredibly poor at managing my time.
Mm.
But it's funny how being paid for stuff kind of focuses the mind in that way. Like when you know you've got to hit a deadline or when you've got, you know, you have to keep paying the bills and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
That kind of forces you to take that kind of stuff a bit more seriously. So I've since being freelance, I've massively improved in my organisational skills, I think.
Right.
Which is one of the things I didn't expect. I mean, I've had a couple of spells of being freelance, but the sort of becoming a better adult human was one of the things that I didn't expect.
The problem, isn't it? You have to actually do that at some point.
Yeah, I have a very sometimes quite silly job where I do these amazing things, and that is the very, I guess, public face of it. And behind the scenes is actually you are kind of working away like a beaver building a dam, trying to make sure everything's properly sorted. So,
Of course. So let's go through kind of the, I was going to say, let's go through your history. So that makes it sound like a job interview. Let's follow the, like, where did you start and what are some of the journeys you've been on through your kind of writing career, shall we say?
Right. So it's been, I've kind of hopped about a bit. I mean, I've always been interested in writing for a start, so I always assumed that was where my career was vaguely going to end up.
Yeah.
But I didn't know the context, so I mean, I did a degree, a BA in business, because I'd come out of school thinking I wanted to do marketing or advertising or something like that, and got to university and decided that that really wasn't for me.
Right.
While I was there, I'd always read car magazines as well. That's the kind of the background.
Yeah.
And when I was in my third year at uni, I realised that you could also do degrees in journalism. And I thought, okay, well, this is one path to do it. So I then did a master's in media and journalism. And while I was doing that and working to pay for it, I also this was kind of when, I guess, Twitter started taking off.
Right, okay.
And so I started connecting with other journalists on Twitter. And at the time, people were searching for writers to do odds and sods on different websites. And I sent a test piece to one of these websites. It was an American site called Motor Authority.
Right.
And actually, at the time, there was one called All Cars Electric, I think, as well. And I did a couple of pieces for these, and they liked what I was doing and said, if you could do a couple of these a week, that would be great. And that couple of week slowly snowballed into working for them pretty regularly.
Yeah.
So I just kind of found myself freelancing.
Yeah.
and I did that for... And by this point, the degree was... Like, the journalism degree was almost like a sideline.
Yeah.
I completed that one, but by then I'd kind of already got...
You'd found your focus in a different way.
Yeah, I'd got a job in the industry that I was getting the degree to attempt to get into.
Yeah.
And I ended up doing that for 3 or 4 years, writing for this American company and slowly doing bits and pieces for, like, early days of Car Throttle, early days of Car Wow when it was still called Car Buzz, and a couple of others. And then after 4 years of doing that, a job at Evo came up.
Nice.
And a friend suggested it, and I applied. And it was, the position was for managing editor, which, as you can imagine, is quite a senior position.
Yeah.
But I had no idea what that was. Like, I'd read Evo magazine for years, but I had no idea what
the hierarchy is. Not just written down on a piece of paper in that way, is it?
But amazingly, I got an interview, and they very quickly twigged that I was not managing edited material, but I was very lucky in that one of your previous guests, Stephen Dobie, had made the decision to leave, and he went to Top Gear magazine, and that opened up a staff writer position. And pretty much the week that Stephen left, I got offered the job. I think I did a week's.
I bet they found you very conveniently timed.
They were looking for a managing editor still, but it just so happened that Stephen had just left, and I pretty much fell straight into his position. And then I stayed at Evo for 6 years. So
fair play. I'm effectively working my way round all of Evo's previous staff.
I think the pinnacle of
this is going to be like Harry Metcalf at some point. I'm going to find a way to get him on, and I can go, right, I've spoken to all of your staff. Yeah. They've all been on. We've chatted with everyone. You're the last piece of the puzzle, and we've got all of Evo's original hierarchy in place. So that's quite a nice tale of, well, I wanted to get into writing, so I thought I'll go down the proper route. And then I accidentally fell into doing it anyway, and then ended up with a proper job doing it. Like, it's quite a nice example of people put a lot of pressure on their education to be the gateway into anything that they want to do.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily the case. Like, my other half is a doctor, so you kind of have to do the uni thing to do that. Like, she's a psychologist, so you have to have a degree and experience and this, that, and the other. That's the traditional path.
Yeah.
But there are people in that industry that are, they're qualified by experience, so you don't necessarily have to do that really structured route. Whereas I technically don't really have any proper formal qualifications. I've got, like, A-levels and some basic accounting qualifications, but it's not, like, a degree or anything like that.
Mm.
So I'm effectively like a complete mirror to her, like, career path. She's like, go to school, go to uni, get a job, do the job, become higher and higher up in the structures of the organisation she works in.
Mm.
And I was like, go to school and then just figure it out.
Yeah.
Good luck. And it can be quite stressful because you kind of never really know where you're heading.
Mm.
But at the same time, I would say I've had a much more interesting career path.
Yeah.
And I probably wouldn't do half the stuff that I do now if I'd been in a mindset where I had to be qualified at something to give it a go.
Yeah.
Because now I can wander up to a racetrack with a camera, take a load of photos and see if that is of worth to anyone.
Yeah.
Whereas before I'd be like, oh, I've got to have a photography degree or I've got to be qualified in photography to then approach the right people and go, oh, I've got this qualification, can I come do work for you? It says that you don't have to do that. A mate of mine is a full-time photographer, and he just wandered around at car events, took a load of photos, and went, oh, if you want more, you pay me for it, and I'll come to your events and do it properly. And
yeah.
People go, all right, okay. And now he's a photographer. Like,
yeah.
It's such an interesting and quite a hope-filled way of kind of speaking to anyone that's in a bit of an unsure situation, going, you don't have to follow the formal routes. You can find other ways. It's not as easily laid out, but you can figure it out.
Yeah, there are certain professions certainly where and motion journalism is one of them, and I think taking photos is another, where proving what you can do is far more important than saying you've got a piece of paper that is a qualification for something.
Yeah.
I don't think, to my knowledge, since I started doing this for a living, I don't think anybody's ever asked what I actually got at university. So from a professional point of view, those degrees have been completely useless. My first actual writing job came from responding to somebody on Twitter looking for a writer.
And
proving that I could write. And in fairness to doing degrees and my previous education, I had to, at some point I had to learn to write and learn to write well and accurately and without making mistakes and all that sort of stuff. And that obviously has been good grounding for what I do. But
that sounds like the education was important as an education, not as a career path.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's very much, I mean, it's kind of like just one long on-the-job training kind of deal.
Yeah.
And photography is the same. I mean, you can, I don't doubt that, music is probably another thing. I don't doubt that you can go on and do formal training for something and become an absolutely brilliant photographer or a musician or any of those kind of things. But there's a lot to be said for just kind of getting stuck in.
Yeah, yeah. Well, to give you credit, when the reason that we've met properly the first time was thanks to Twitter.
Mm, yeah.
As is unfortunately a dying thing with Twitter's current case. But that was, I've got a t-shirt that has a a Mazda-inspired logo. Mm. Is there anyone nearby me that has an RX-7 that I can just chuck a t-shirt on and take some photos of? And you're like, well, I'm near you. Why don't we just meet up and take some photos?
Mm.
And that was, I think I'd had a camera for a week at that point. So you very kindly let me learn how to take some photos. And those photos, on reflection, I might go back and re-edit them, were nowhere near as good as what I can do now. But this was, what, a little over a year ago?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
And it's one of those where it's like, you only kind of get better by being crap at something and learning where you've gone wrong and trying again and again and finding the different ways to do it. And I think any sort of creative outlet is going to have that element to it no matter what. Take George Williams, for example. He's never done any formal training.
Mm.
Even with his Photoshop, Adobe asked him to show them his process.
Right.
And they went, oh, you're not following what we expected. And he went, well, no, because I've never sat and read a manual or had any training. I've just figured this out. And they went, yeah, but if you did that, it's a shortcut. And he's like, oh, so I've been wasting all this time because I've no formal training whatsoever. But George is one of the most renowned car photographers in the world.
Yeah.
So it's like, would having had photography degree made any difference to his life? Might have made him a little bit quicker.
Mm.
But he's learnt that skill through trial and error and just getting better and better and better. And I took some light painting photos of my car around Christmas time after he'd done the Zenvo Northern Lights shots of their new supercar. And I sent took a photo of my camera while I was doing it because we're relatively good pals. And like he just replied with, oh, your f-stop's too high and your ISO's too low. And it was like, if you make these tweaks, you'll find that it works better. So then I was kind of like, oh, that's a level of knowledge that you can only get by trial and error and knowing what you're talking about that I wouldn't have even noticed. I'd have just gone, oh, you've got like photos. Let's go and fiddle around with them. Do you find that you've started to get to that point in your writing where you can go, oh, this tiny little difference I can pick up on because I've got quite a wealth of experience to it, and it would make a huge impact on the end result?
Writing's certainly a trial and error thing. I guess that's one area. I mean, certainly knowing people who are better than you at stuff is really helpful as well. I mean, I was very lucky that my first proper writing job for the American company, I had an actual proper editor above me who could give me feedback on stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that's maybe something you don't get when you're, say, writing a blog just to the, well, and not that anybody writes blogs anymore, I guess, but
I kind of do.
Yeah, but that's it's one of those things where you don't get, I guess, immediate feedback on that, and most, and you know, most readers either don't notice or probably don't care unless something's genuinely filled with errors and stuff.
Mm.
But yeah, I suppose writing doesn't have quite as obvious a failure state as a photography. I mean, I do a bit of just in my own time, a bit of film photography at the moment, and that's definitely when you can't immediately look up the photo you've taken, you just have to wait until you get a roll of negatives back and stuff, and then you think, oh well, two-thirds of that expensive roll of film I just took is complete garbage.
Oh God, that's so frustrating.
Yeah, but that's photography is kind of great in that way, and writing's maybe slightly different in that you kind of need people with more experience telling you where something's not that great. Or again, I'm kind of lucky in that when I submit copy to people, maybe because I was kind of relatively old before I started getting into proper magazines and stuff. Like, that's the other thing I want to say is, it's if you are going through an education at the moment with the goal of reaching a particular job, you don't need to rush. I mean, I was 28 or 29 when I finally got a job at Evo, something like that.
Really?
Yeah, so
Because I thought you were like 35 now.
no, well, I'm 38 now, nearly 39. So, but yeah, so I was kind of experienced in the writing side, but then again, joining Evo, I was off to a good start, but I then had actual editors and sub-editors and stuff around me who could mould my writing further. And that is really important from the writing perspective, especially, is having people who really know what they're doing, and who have kind of read a great many people's words to kind of figure out what works and what doesn't. And certainly when you're writing for a magazine as well, you if it's one you've spent a lot of long time reading, like Evo, and I'd been reading it for probably 15 years before I started working there. And you kind of get a feel for their style as well.
Yeah, there's like an overarching language to it all, isn't it? Like
Yeah.
it has its own tone and approach rather than just being an amalgamation of 20 different voices in a room.
Yeah. Everybody's writing style is obviously individual, but you know the goal you're writing towards. And again, I guess it's the same with, I mean, I'd say I'm very much an amateur photographer, but you kind of know what shots you want to take before you take them, and that's the same thing. It's like, what do I want to achieve with this photograph? And it's kind of the same with writing.
So that tailors how you set things up, doesn't it? If I'm, say, watching live action motorsport and I want a tracking shot where the car is in focus and everything else is blurry, I've got to set the camera up a different way to if I just want a still of what's going on at that given moment. And I imagine that's the same when you're approaching your writing, is you will tailor the structure of what you're talking about to fit a certain style rather than just going, I drove this car, here's how fast it is, here's how well it corners is, and then you go, there's a story here and we're following this flow in a certain way.
Yeah, and you get a feel for certain publications whether to be kind of a bit irreverent or whether you need to be, you know, straight down the line and a bit serious, or if it's a consumer publication, not using flowery language that makes no sense to most people. And so, yeah, there's a lot of different styles, and you kind of, after a while, get a feel for them. And that is something which comes with experience as well.
Yeah, I can imagine, because I find I'm very much at the very beginning of doing writing properly. It's essentially just how I would talk most things. Unfortunately, the piece I do for Redline is essentially my opinion on something. So it's usually towards the community or how cars connect us, that sort of stuff. So I can be very much myself and go, well, this is how I would tell this story if we were sat face to face talking about it, which I think works for that kind of piece. But if someone went, we need you to do like a factual breakdown of a market or performance of this, that, and the other, I'd be very much at a loss as to what the appropriate way to start that would be, which I guess is where this experience and learning and being able to reach out to people that have done it all before and go, where the hell do I start? Like, what is the thing that I need to do to make sure that this is how it's expected?
Although you'll have a feel for it as well, even just from reading stuff and kind of, you know, if you read different magazines and even among enthusiast publications, everyone is slightly different. Like, I will write slightly differently for Evo than I do for Octane, for instance. Even though they are both aimed at enthusiasts, you tend to assume a degree of knowledge from the reader already, which you might not for a consumer publication. And I reckon even people who, you know, there are people out there who probably don't see themselves as great writers, but if they read enough stuff, they will still have an idea of, you know, differences between people's output.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And a lot of writers are known for the way that they approach writing. Like, if you take Clarkson versus Frankl, they have a different style to how they approach the same topic.
Yeah.
And it's quite fun learning that. Like, it's something I need to get better at doing, is just sitting down and reading magazines again, because in this current day and age, the mobile phone is so, like, it's there and it's vying for your attention all the time.
Yeah.
It's quite a conscious decision to not engage with it and to sit down. I think I'm missing the latest Road Rat. Behind all this stack of clothes, there's actually a load of magazines. And it used to be part of my morning routine, was I'd get up, make myself a cup of coffee, sit down and read an article in Road Rat and go, yeah, I've indulged in something that is quite analogue and proper and takes time to consume.
Yeah.
Rather than going, oh, let's just scroll through Instagram reels for an hour, which turns into 2 hours, which turns into half the day. And you go, what have I actually done with my day? I've consumed irrelevant crap and hopefully got some ideas for content that might help other people consume irrelevant crap, which will give my numbers a nice big boost. And then you're caught in this little addictive cycle of social media, which has its ups and its downs. Like, as we've already mentioned, Twitter has connected us. It's connected you to what ultimately got you a job at Evo through that byline. But at the same time, it can be an absolute waste of time and just a sap of energy for no real reason and no real value.
Well, the indulging in magazines thing, I think, is that is still... I struggle to read long-form stuff on the internet. Like, I'm aware there are a great many people doing amazing kind of long-form features and things solely for the internet, but I sadly almost never read them, because for me to feel like an indulgence, I still need paper magazines. And I buy loads of the things still, because that is the way, I think, partly because that is a proportion of your day that you don't have to spend looking at a screen. And if your job involves a lot of looking at screens, and then in a lot of your free time, you also, you know, watch YouTube and scroll Twitter and all those sort of things.
My new gaming rig is right behind you.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's and you game and all those other things. Then it starts a bit like driving does. It starts to feel like a real luxury being away from a screen, and magazines just still do that for me like nothing else. However good something on the internet is, it still doesn't compare to picking up a good magazine and taking time to read a feature, or reading cover to cover.
You feel so much more connected to what you're actually doing then, don't you? There is this, the screen is a portal to somewhere else feeling, where it doesn't feel like you're actually there, where you're actually involved, whereas actually picking up and turning the pages, it's so much more kind of connected. It's almost like that touch grass kind of mindset of just go and be present in the world for once, rather than looking through this little window into what's going on somewhere else.
Yeah, and weirdly, it's kind of more permanent as well. I know so many journalists who've had a significant proportion of their work just disappear from the internet.
It's happened so recently with one of the big buyouts.
Yeah, a few, I think. You get a lot of these stories cropping up where a magazine or like a website staff have been told to save anything they want to save because the servers are being wiped.
I think it was Vice might have been the most recent one that I'd heard of, where it was like everything on Vice is about to get deleted. And people are like, my whole back catalogue of career work is on there. And that's how I've been approaching new places, to go, look at how good I am at writing.
Yeah.
Here's a link to all the articles. And they go, all of my kind of CV of work is about to just vanish.
Yeah.
Whereas you can go, here's an Evo magazine with my name written down in it.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I still, you know, paper won't last forever, but they say the stuff on the internet is permanent, but actually it's weirdly impermanent.
Yeah.
Like, I've got magazines from 50, 60, 70 years ago still. And that content still exists and you can still read it. Whereas,
and the adverts are all full of cigarettes and you're like, oh my God, Marlboro actually had an advert.
But the chances of something I write on the internet still being there in 50, 60, 70 years is actually quite slim.
Yeah. Well, storage is a commodity now, isn't it?
Yeah.
So if you want something hosted online for a long period of time, you've got to pay a lot of money. And if it's not continuously getting views and clicks, people aren't going to pay for it.
Yeah. So I feel fortunate that the stuff I'm most proud of has been in print and will still be in somebody's kind of loft or something in decades to come.
Yeah.
And I have had stuff disappear from the internet, but I feel lucky that if it's, you know, the worst thing probably for car journalists, it tends to be, say, new car reviews, because for SEO purposes, a lot of those just get completely written over when a new car comes out, and so that the website still has the search traffic. But if a first drive of something disappears from a website, I'm not actually that bothered. That feels fleeting enough that it doesn't bother me. But if I'd put my magnum opus on a website somewhere,
yeah, absolutely,
and somebody got rid of it, that would be absolutely crushing.
So that one of those where you go, I spent a lot of time researching and going into a story rather than like a current affairs news bit like a first drive would be. I've done some digging and created this story around something of interest that people might want to just read for its value as a thing.
Yeah.
And then they've gone, well, we don't need that page anymore, delete. And you go, but I spent so much time on that, and I was really proud of that piece of work. Whereas, as you've said, having it written down, nobody can take that away from you. Like, you've got a physical thing in your hand.
Yeah.
I saw a thing the other day that was, it was relevant to, like, the internet isn't permanent, blah, blah, blah. And it was like, I'm going to have all of my Trustpilot reviews inscribed on titanium tablets. And it was a reference joke back to the first customer review that was inscribed on I think it was like a bronze tablet about an Egyptian, I think it was like a linen trader or something like that.
Oh, right, yeah.
And it's the first written down thing they'd ever found, or something stupid. And it was this guy moaning about the quality of the copper he'd received or something.
Well, there are
similar
things.
That's permanent.
Yeah, there are similar things. They're still excavating bits of Pompeii, aren't they? And they keep on finding, again, not just smutty pictures that people have painted on walls and stuff there, but they find things like so-and-so's business is terrible, and it's fantastic. Like, people are reviewing local businesses on the side of walls and things like that, and they're still digging that kind of stuff out.
We went to Pompeii last year, and it wasn't until we got back that someone went, oh, did you see all the penis arrows? I was like, why? It's like, yeah, they used to draw penises to point you to where all the brothels were.
Yeah.
And they're still there. I was like, can you imagine knowing that that was going to last 2,000 years or however long it's been? And being like, yeah, it's this way to the brothel, lads. Like, it's so insane that we forget how permanent some stuff has been.
Yeah.
And it doesn't feel permanent until someone re-digs it up and you go, oh, we found this thing. You're like, geez, that existed 5,000 years ago in Egypt or something like that.
Yeah.
And it still somewhat exists now for us to look back and go, yeah, that guy was really crap at selling copper or whatever it was. And I imagine if that guy could see that now, he'd be like, as if that's what I'm immortalized for, as being the original bad copper merchant.
Yeah, they find you entombed in ash in Herculaneum or one of these places. and everybody knows that you were the terrible blacksmith in the area.
Exactly. In some ways, I'd rather my work get deleted from the internet than have immortalized in stone in a volcanic covered city. But have you found, for the kind of workload that you're getting, we're seeing a little bit of a resurgence in the print media? Or has it remained relatively consistent?
I would love to think so. I think we are at a point where people are aware that it's some places are kind of struggling a bit, and I think there will be enough support to keep magazines and things taking over from the people who really, really care about that. And it may mean magazines and things like that going to different models, like we've seen certainly in the States. Road and Track went from a monthly magazine to I think they're either quarterly or bi-monthly, and it went a bit more upscale and it's a bit thicker and the paper's a bit nicer and stuff. And one of the other American mags has recently done the same, and I suspect that will happen more in the UK as well.
Because it feels like it's now being driven more by the enthusiast than it is by the marketing side of being a viable project.
Yeah.
Like, people are buying it because it's something good that they want to read, rather than the advertisers paying for it to exist for the advertising benefits.
And it ties into that, it being an escape thing, I think. I see magazines, I see print media in general being very much like classic cars, and being like vinyl, and being like like, what other things I know?
Film photography.
Film photography, a great example, yeah. All those kind of things where it's well past its kind of peak as being the default way that people consume a particular type of information, but there will always be a number of people who just love the way that is done and love what it gives them, that something more fleeting or more distracting like the internet might not. And so we could have this conversation in 5 years' time, and it wouldn't surprise me if more of the magazines that are currently on sale in the UK have gone to like something slightly more upscale, slightly more expensive, but even more worth buying for enthusiasts.
Yeah, which kind of puts like Road Rat and Magneto at the head of the curve, really, doesn't it? Mm. They're making that high quality. It's about the stories. It's not the current affairs model.
Yeah,
I think I've sat and learned more about like interesting things that happened 80 years ago at Goodwood through those kind of magazines than I ever would have encountered on the internet, because that stuff doesn't get the clicks. It's not grabbing your attention in that moment. Whereas if you're spending the time to go, well, I actually want to just sit and indulge in the culture and the history of the thing I'm passionate about, you actually take in where things have come from and the stuff that isn't necessarily an attention-grabby headline or something like that.
Yeah, well, there are people on the internet doing absolutely amazing things and putting out incredible stories and high production values and stuff, but there is almost an inverse relationship by how much effort people put into something and how special the story might be to how many people actually see it, because it is kind of much easier to do something cheap and quick and headline-grabby.
Yeah. Oh, social media at the minute is a wild place to be learning. Like, I, for the purposes of growing the name, spend quite a lot of time trying to find what works.
Mm.
And what I've come across recently is I could spend a day taking some really nice photos or making some really high-ish value video stuff and put it on Instagram, and it gets, we'll say, 1,000 views, which is reasonably, it's 10% of my audience, whatever. Or I can line up the Gran Turismo 6 trailer with the Hyundai Motorsport. Effectively, what they did was a shot-for-shot remake with their team doing Hyundai rally stuff.
Mm.
Line them up and put a caption that goes, Hyundai have absolutely smashed this. And it's essentially showing something to people that they might not have seen.
Yeah.
And that, I think that got something like 700,000 views.
Mm.
It's like, that took me maybe 15 minutes just to line everything up, get all the sound to line up right, and make sure that it worked. And it's got more than a day's worth of work, like hundreds of times more engagement and views, because that's what social media wants. Social media wants something that will grab your attention, will get you to share it with your mates, because you're the first person to have shared it, and then people go, oh my God, have you seen this? And then you're effectively like a current events platform to a certain extent, but within your own niche. Like, that seems to be where social media is wanting, or at least rewarding with engagement. Whereas you try and build a bit of a niche for going, oh, we do cars and clothing and coffees and cars and this, that and the other, we're trying to build community.
Mm.
And this one goes, great, there's only 100 people in the area that give a shit. So we'll show it to them. And you're like, brilliant. I don't know if that's of any worth or not, because it might have shown it to the wrong 100 people.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a real kind of, it's something that I'm very actively thinking about at the minute, is not falling into that pit of just making stuff for the sake of making stuff in the hopes that social media will reward you with it.
Mm.
And at the same time, it's like, well, if you do enough of that mixed in with enough unique things to what you're up to, you can grow a big enough audience that might start to see the other stuff.
Yeah.
And then as you approach new places with a bit of an audience, people want to actually start having the conversations with you, because they go, oh, you've got a bit of an audience.
Yeah.
It's this real kind of balancing act of finding the right mix of those three things to make it grow. And I think if you're trying to do anything in of any sort of worth, it's really hard to get right.
Yeah.
And you see it with the content that comes out within the automotive world. It's all, look at this, isn't this flash, isn't this mad, isn't it wild? And it's not necessarily, did you know 100 years ago these guys were flying around a concrete bowl at 130 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And you'd be like, that's insane. But it's not a wild enough story for the internet to send to teenagers and get loads of views about.
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly stories I've got in my kind of big list of things, which, I mean, even just kind of selling them to an outlet is difficult, because it might be an incredibly interesting story, but when you've got limited space to fill a magazine with, even something fairly specialist might just not grab attention.
It's, yeah, yeah.
And it might not be worth a publication spending money on. I don't do social media in any professional capacity, but it has struck me in the past how the most throwaway, ridiculous thing I can stick on Twitter might get enormous reach, and something very serious or a link to an article or something that I've written, which I'm really proud of, may get nothing at all. So, but I think you kind of, in some way, have to just accept that that is the way the world works. And I'm content in the knowledge that I do enough kind of stuff that I'm pleased with that it kind of doesn't matter whether people see it or not sometimes. It's nice if they do, but it's almost, a lot of this is for me as much as it is for everybody else. So, and if I make a stupid post on Twitter about something and that goes mad, then that's just what people want.
Fair enough. Yeah, moment, yeah. So, I think it's nice that you can be in a position where you go, I do the things that I like to do, and I do these for me.
Yeah.
And it pays the bills. Well, that's quite a nice point to be at, where you're effectively doing something you enjoy, and if 10 people see it or a million people see it, you've done it and enjoyed it either way.
Yeah.
And it's paid the bills for you, so you don't have to kind of go, oh my God, this has to be successful right at this moment for me to afford to put fuel in the car or something like that.
Yeah, and I think that's maybe, that kind of thing is maybe more tricky if you are starting a project from scratch on something. Like if you build something for a living and you've got this amazing device that you want to sell to the world, that you know, you've poured your heart and soul into it, but that kind of does need to get bought and seen and stuff to pay the bills. Whereas, I guess one of the nice things about writing is that the important stuff doesn't necessarily need to pay the bills, and the stuff in the background, I mean, everything is important. Like I try and put a lot of effort into every different gig I get, but it might be that the passion project is not the thing which ultimately makes a difference in terms of how like paying my rent and stuff.
So. Yeah, yeah. No, it's a nice like perspective that a lot of people miss, because a lot of us get caught up in the chase of the big thing, and then we kind of forget that you don't have to be caught up in that spiral. You can learn how to do a lot of the less big stuff and still enjoy doing that, rather than having to be like, if I don't get these big jobs, I hate what I'm up to, and I'm just doing the smaller stuff because I have to do that. And it's not it clearly isn't the case, because you're enjoying every aspect, regardless of what the job is, and you're not having to go, right, I've got to write 10 clickbait articles today to make sure that I can afford to pay the bills. You can do quite smartly what you're doing and have the background stuff with the cherry on top being the big passion project here and there.
I think as long as, and fair pay is always an issue, and I think lots of industries, I think as long as you're being paid fairly for something in the first place, even the doing clickbait articles kind of isn't so bad. Like if you know, there are people who probably write for some of these websites who don't get paid very much at all, and they're just churning this stuff out. But I always, every time I'm having a bad day, I just think I'm still writing for a living. Like I could be doing something far worse than sitting at my desk, like doing something which, you know, isn't kind of something I'm passionate about necessarily, but I could be doing something far worse than sitting at my desk, being able to go for lunch when I want and getting paid kind of fairly to write something that's maybe not that interesting.
Much worse
ways to make a living.
There's a huge thing about that fair payment thing for freelancers at the minute, especially with the rise of the clickbait article, and it's that like pence per word thing and stuff like that, and people go in, you have to really churn out a lot of crap to make a living doing that model. And it's quite a sad story to see play out, especially on like Twitter, when someone's like, oh, here's an article, we're hiring for a writer or something. It's like, oh, what's your, it's 20p per cent or whatever it is, and you go, Well, for that to be a viable living wage, I've got to write 20 of these articles a day.
Yeah.
And you've got to pay me for all of them for me to make, just to pay the rent, that kind of thing. Mm. And I think it's becoming almost like a bit of a trap where they say, I want to be a writer. It's like, right, this is where you start. You earn nothing, you work a lot, and you're not treated with any respect. And the stuff that you write, you're not really passionate about. And it's going to kill a lot of people's passion for creative writing.
Yeah. Especially, I would always say to somebody who wanted to get into that, the industry, to be realistic. Like, it's not a bad place to work, but it's certainly isn't the best thing in the world to do. And some of that comes down to where you start and how much money you can make from it, because it's fair that when you start, you aren't necessarily going to be paid the most in the world.
Yeah.
But you can't do that forever. Like, if you're trying to break into the space, you can't be paid at some pitiful rate the entire time if you want to make a living. Because
it's
not
sustainable, is it?
Yeah, it's not sustainable. It's going to sour you on something that you might otherwise love doing.
Yeah.
The trouble is, I suppose, the way the industry is at the moment is I'm not just talking about cars here as well, but getting into journalism in general there are fewer and fewer kind of big publications who pay the rates that maybe they should, and I guess a widening pool of people who want to get into the industry because the internet has made it, it's democratized writing, essentially. Like, anybody from any background can pretty much get into that industry now, but so you've got this kind of shrinking pool of good jobs and a growing pool of writers, and that
I guess
makes
that's
difficult,
forcing the cream to the top in a certain extent, though.
In some ways, I mean, it's difficult to say. Like, they reckon that the best, you know, you've probably heard the best kind of racing driver in the world isn't in F1. There is somebody somewhere in the world who is just an incredible driver, and they just will never ever get the opportunity to.
I know,
to
I'm stuck driving the GT86. But no, you're absolutely right. And a lot of the top end of any given space, F1 being a great example, is never who's there on merit alone.
Mm.
You've got to be either very well connected, very wealthy, or incredibly marketable to get pushed up to that level. There's always more to it than skill.
And there are probably some, as a result, there are probably some amazing writers just kind of struggling along doing stuff they don't want to be doing, who could be in the right position with the right opportunities, could be doing something incredible. And that is kind of the trouble with the entire industry at the moment, is finding those people who really deserve to be, you know, changing the world with their writing and don't have the opportunity.
Yeah. It's a real shame, really, because you'd think something that is a creative subject would be, well, if you're really good at it, people will find out because you write really good stuff and people go, wow, that's really good. And then they'll tell someone else who goes, oh, yeah, that's really good. And you think that that would be the way that it gets through, but evidently not the case.
Yeah. And it's a weird one as well, because theoretically, you know, in the past, there were far fewer opportunities. Like, if you wanted to become a motoring writer back in the day, then you worked your hardest to apply to all the different car magazines in the UK, which was, you know, a handful of things beyond the specialist publications.
Yeah.
Like, you could attempt to write for Motor or Car or Autocar or some of those ones back in the 80s.
Mm.
And if you couldn't get into that, then you were kind of out of luck. Like, you just had to do something else. Like,
it's not like you could start your own news outlet like you can now with a website.
Yeah, exactly. And that is the one advantage people do have today, is they can kind of explore so many more different avenues, which is why I say it's not a bad profession to try and get into, because at least you can kind of make your own luck in some ways.
Yeah, absolutely.
And connect with people so much easier. Like, the Twitter thing, much as Twitter's a absolute cesspit at the moment, like, it's still a really good way of, like, you know, pretty much, I would guess, a significant proportion of journalists at publications across the world are probably on Twitter in some form, and you can reach these people directly now.
Yeah, it's still clinging on to a little bit of value for people. It's just you have to dig through so much more crap to find it.
Mm.
But to kind of swing back towards cars a bit more, as I'm conscious that I've essentially turned this into what's journalism like?
Yeah.
What are some of the those kind of big passion pieces that have kind of sprinkled throughout your career that you look back on with fondness?
That is a tricky one, because there have been a few, and I guess one of the troubles with this job is once you've done it and it's been published, you almost forget about it.
Right.
So I've certainly done some very cool things. Well, that's the other thing. I've done some cool things and written stories that were good, but not my favourites. Mm. I've done some less cool things, which I've managed to turn into something which I'm really proud of. As far as memorable ones go, one of the ones that still sticks in my head was off the back of a Tokyo Motor Show trip, I managed to get together the old and new Honda NSXs.
Oh, nice.
It wasn't a track test or anything. It wasn't even like a doing big skids kind of photography feature, but I managed to speak to, Mark Riccioni was doing the photography for it, so he was out with Honda, and he was the snapper for this one.
Of course it was Mark. He's such a good photographer.
Yeah, well, this was his first trip to Japan as well. He was like stars in his eyes the entire time. Yeah. But he put me in contact with Blake Jones, who at the time was working for Toyota, but he writes for Speed Hunters. And Blake was living out in Japan, and he had an original NSX, so that was the car we borrowed. But he also kind of serves as interpreter for going to a couple of the places we visited. And we went to a specialist that was sticking a manual gearbox in his NSX, and we had the new one from Honda. And it was just one of these almost like Gran Turismo fantasies made real, driving a couple of NSXs through Tokyo, like on some of the expressways and through some of the side streets and stuff.
That sounds so cool.
Yeah, and we went to sort of Daikoku parking area, which is the big one with all the roads going around it.
And so,
that was kind of surreal. And the piece I wrote for it was quite a philosophical one, because the new NSX had come out, and it was primarily an American project, really. It was designed there, built there, all those kind of things. And it was kind of figuring out whether NSX people thought it was an NSX.
Or whether it was an American car masquerading, essentially.
Yeah, and so that one always sticks in my mind, I guess, mostly because of where it was.
Yeah.
But there have been the kind of opportunities to drive the cool stuff which I'd never had an opportunity to in the past. The cars that I read about in magazines when I was growing up.
Yeah.
And those are always fun as well. So I've done, you know, features on a Integra Type R, and it's not all Hondas as well, I should say.
Anthony Ingram, Honda writer.
Yeah. You've kind of caught me off guard a bit, because I'm
prepared for this as much as you are. This wasn't I'll catch him.
But the trouble is, we'll get out of this room and then I'll immediately think of all the features that I've done, which I should have said. But it's just been cool. I mean, I've done bits and pieces for, I know you've had Will Beaumont on. Co-wrote a big 7 series piece in the most recent issue of Verka.
So you have to call him Vil. You can't call him Will.
Vil Beaumont.
Because it's Vil from Verka, yeah.
I was really
perpetuating the idea that everyone starts calling him Vil as well.
Well, I was really pleased with that one. I mean, we co-wrote that. We each did kind of different generations of the 7 series, and Vil had a really kind of fun theme for it, because we went to this old Cold War airbase. The idea was we were not just writing about the cars, but kind of covering the significant events that these cars might have been tied to, because they were obviously 7 series are very, they're the kind of cars for moving dignitaries around. So you go right back to the start of the 7 series in the 1970s, and that's obviously a very different kind of atmosphere to the more recent ones.
Yeah.
And I guess that just from those two shows the variety of it as well. It's absolutely always something different, and it's always coming up with a new interesting way of covering a car, particularly if it's an older one as well. That's one of the troubles with, I've done a lot of kind of classic car stuff, and trying to present a car that everybody's very aware of in a way that nobody's seen before is very tricky.
I can imagine. I think you've probably got a little bit of luck with a younger audience learning about them.
Definitely, yeah.
Rather than just the people that saw them when they came out.
Mm.
So a couple of friends of mine are big into their 7 series, and they're my age and younger, if anything. And we were at a Car Hoona event a couple of months back, and one of them was in a brown over brown 7 Series.
Mm.
And it was like that goldy brown paint with a tan brown interior, or a light.
Was that the mic? It has a. It's an E38, is it? Or
yeah, on the 16s.
Yeah, and it's got it's been lowered a bit. And
it's got the original mobile phone in the
yeah.
centre.
Yeah, yeah, I think that was in
Mike.
The...
He's got a. He does interesting cars. Interesting,
yeah, interesting cars of London or something. Yeah,
yeah, him.
Yeah,
and Jasper Dardashti, who was of Car and Classic, is now of Carhuna.
Mm.
He's just bought an E38 as well.
Right.
In the James Bond spec. So the silver with the silver wheels, like proper one.
Mm. Shorty sporty, as they call it.
Yeah. So those two are absolute nerds about all this.
Yeah.
I know nothing. I know that's a 7 Series, and that's about as far as I can get.
Mm.
And Jasper was like, they're different wheels. I was like, oh, it is different wheels. Like, how do you know that? He went, no, the car didn't originally come with those wheels. It came with these wheels, and it had this and this and this. I was like, this is a level of nerd that I... I'm still new to.
Mm.
And then I kind of have to sit and go, I've only really been in the car world proper since like 2020.
Mm.
Before that, it was like I liked cars, but I liked looking at them and hearing them and watching them, and I didn't really know that in-depth stuff about cars. And it's only through kind of being around them and being around the people that do know that you kind of learn this stuff. But those two properly know their stuff about old BMWs in general.
That is an interesting point, because I always find that's certainly one of the difficulties about writing about older cars, is that there are people out there whose entire life is the thing you're writing about.
Yeah.
And I the way I see it is in what I do, I need to know maybe 75% about, say, 1,000 different cars. Mm. But there are people out there who know 100% about one single car, and some of these people are never going to be happy with what you've written, because yeah. they ultimately know more than you. Like, as a writer who does this stuff for a living, you cannot know everything about every car you write about.
Yeah.
And trying to write something that is accessible to new people but also kind of keeps the real mark experts happy, is that's quite tricky.
No, I can imagine. Like, it's very easy to make a very small mistake in, like, getting the letters the wrong way round on a model number or something like that. It's like, you just get inundated with, oh, you got that wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, but 99% of what I've written is factually correct.
Mm.
And I don't know as much as you. And immediately that was wrong.
Yeah.
Oh. And you're held to such a high standard because you are a writer and you are a journalist and you should know better. And people forget, you have to know quite a lot about quite a lot to be able to do that properly.
Yeah, because as soon as I've finished writing one feature, well, it's the same for everybody, as soon as everybody's written one feature, they're on to the next thing.
Yeah.
And they kind of then have to be a 5-minute expert in that to kind of get the point across.
Yeah, yeah, you've gone from writing about an old 7 Series to writing about a brand new Honda, and you're like, well, there's no crossover here. They're completely separate to each other and completely different in what you're talking about and what's relevant to those cars.
Yeah, and certainly if it's an older car as well, you're kind of reliant on how accurate people in the past were. Like, I buy these sort of big portfolios of all the different magazine tests and stuff whenever I'm writing about anything, to see what people wrote about it back in the day. And you know, there's not always consistent information between people who are writing about something 50 years ago. So
yeah, absolutely.
You then have to kind of interpret that in some way to make sure it's vaguely accurate in the modern day. So
it sounds like a nightmare. I don't know how you have the attention span to go into that kind of level. Like, because most people will go, I need to learn about something, I'll go to Wikipedia, see what that says, and then I'll look up a couple of reviews, and it's a half-hour Google job.
Mm.
Whereas to actually research something is so much more time-consuming and in-depth. And I personally find it difficult to figure out where to start.
Mm.
So it must be a skill that you have to kind of develop, as well as learning how to write properly, is going, right, I need to know information about this thing. The internet doesn't have very much about it. Where do I go? Like, what's the easiest way to start on that?
I certainly, from my perspective, it is going back and finding old car magazines and stuff.
Yeah.
And that's where things like it's great that Autocar's now doing the archive, because that's just such an amazing resource.
Yeah.
But ultimately, you are kind of shopping around for old magazines on eBay and stuff like that. That's useful for the older stuff.
You just need to become really good friends with Richard Gooding, because he's got a garage full of old magazines. And every time I see him, he's like, I'm getting shit for this garage full of magazines again.
Lander Keith Jones with his entire library of, stuff in his house. But yeah, it's buying old magazines, old brochures. If you can, I mean, the really fascinating thing, and it's one of those things that kind of makes the job, is talking to people who, if you're lucky enough, people who were working on these things back in the day. Like the MX5 book that I wrote a decade ago, I didn't have the opportunity at the time, but more recently, to update that, I've been speaking to some of the people who worked on the original MX5. And that's just amazing. Like, because it's not just, I mean, the one thing is, you've got all these people who were working on these things 30, 40 years ago who are still super passionate about it. And that just, that always makes things easy. If these people kind of loved what they're doing and they're still proud of what they did all those years ago, that makes interviewing them a real pleasure. But also that's the first-hand information that every journalist craves.
The dream piece of information.
Yeah, to get something slightly different from somebody else, and have it in, well, their own words, but your own words as well, so you're not just using second-hand information all the time.
Yeah.
And those, again, that, not to kind of continue this entire chat about journalism only, but that's one of those things that kind of comes with time, like making connections. So.
Yeah, yeah. It's a real big part of what makes the world work, really, is meeting people and learning from people.
Mm.
And I think it's something that currently we don't pay enough attention to as a general kind of mindset, because everyone goes, oh, we've got the internet, it's got everything we ever need.
Mm.
And then it's only when you try and actually start digging for stuff properly that you realise that the internet's quite limited in specific stuff.
Yeah.
And knowing people and talking to people will get you so much more information.
Mm.
I had it firsthand with William Haynes, and how it was his granddad that originally was building the E-Tides, which I didn't know until he was telling me. He was like, yeah, when granddad was doing this, I was like, what do you mean when granddad? He was like, yeah, my granddad built the first one. I was like, that's a piece of key information that I probably should have known. But it's that kind of, you can then deep dive into a subject matter, because that's the people that were making it. They know what was going on at the time because they had to physically do it. And when I was chatting with him, he was like, yeah, we know that this car from this specific date had these rivets, and the next one had the rivets here because this one got in the way of that one and created this problem, and this is the fix. And you're like, Google's not going to tell me that.
Yeah.
There's not a chance Google's telling me that piece of information. It's not until you stood with the guy that's making them that goes, yeah, this one has to have this hole here for a grommet because the wires have to go through that bit. Whereas before they went round and they would rub and then they would split. So they put a hole through so you could get a grommet. And you're like, that is a piece of information that you cannot get from just doing some Google searches.
Yeah.
And then his level of knowledge of the whole E-type matter is just ridiculous, especially the early ones. And he can gauge the age of a car by how deep the pressings are. Because the early ones will have a deeper pressing because the press hasn't worn out as much.
Right,
whereas the later ones will have a shallower pressing until they replace the tool in 1962 and put a new press on there, and then you see them go back to deep again. And it's like just a ridiculously in-depth piece of information that only comes from first-hand experience. Or talking to your granddad about how he was making E-types, which like Will was probably the only person that can have that conversation with his granddad. And it must be such a valuable thing when you're putting together a piece and you get to sit there and chat to the person that was doing it. Like, I happened to meet Ayrton Senna's mechanic. And it was just this, like, world-opening moment where you go, this guy was there when this was happening. And it was purely by chance. We were at an event at Goodwood and someone had a little Honda, like, monkey bike that we couldn't get started. And one of the other guys, it was like friends of a friend that would all come down. He pulled a small screwdriver out of his shirt pocket, which any Formula One mechanic from the 60s and 70s would have actually done, or the 80s and 90s even, just has a screwdriver in his pocket. And he was fiddling away. He went, yeah, yeah, I remember having to try and sort these carburetors out back in the day. And his wife was like, yeah, that little Brazilian fella, he was relentless in how much work he wanted doing. And we were like, hang on a minute. Honda mechanic, Brazilian fella, who are you talking about? She's like, oh yeah, you know, what's his name? Ayrton. And we were like, Ayrton Senna. And it just transpired that this guy was his mechanic while he raced in Formula One for Honda. And we were all just stood there like, the stories this guy has and the experiences and the things that had happened,
yeah,
you're not going to get that, the energy of that through the internet or an Instagram reel telling you about Ayrton Senna's five biggest near misses and this, that and the other.
Yeah.
It's not going to convey it.
Or even books and magazines. Like the chances that Autosport spoke to this guy back in the day are actually quite slim. So you kind of can't go and buy old magazines for that, and you kind of just need to find out how these people are. And it starts getting, without getting morbid, it starts getting quite pressing because
people are getting old.
Yeah, you go back a certain amount of time and these people are getting old and they won't be here forever to be able to talk to about these things. So that kind of that turns up the pressure on trying to get these amazing stories now while they're still around to tell them.
I saw on Twitter recently, someone had done a thing with the Blue Train Bentley as its kind of core style. And the photo they used was of one of those recreation cars that's got like the leather padding on the outside that isn't the original Blue Train car that was the story.
Mm.
It was an homage to that story. And if you know the ins and outs a little bit, you know that if the car looks like that, it's the homage car. The actual car wasn't a Cruella de Vil looking thing. Yeah. It was just an old Bentley. And someone pointed it out that they'd used the wrong car as their, like, this design is connected to this car. Mm. And there's this back and forth. And ultimately the guy went, well, I spoke to the man that raced the original car about the original car with the original car. So I kind of think I've got the authority topped on this one. And it's like, that is the closest we're ever going to get to speaking to that guy that did the Blue Train run.
Yeah.
Because that guy, it's no longer with us, but this guy who's like in his 50s or 60s and got limited time in comparison.
Mm.
We need to utilise these stories while they're still secondhand, but it's as close as we're going to get to firsthand at this point.
Yeah.
And kind of going, right, we need to write this down as you tell it so that for future generations, it's got something in existence.
I don't envy, though, the people who are building some of these vintage cars and stuff. And they, I mean, certainly if the original people aren't around, a lot of the time all they have to go on is black and white photographs, and you think that's quite a project ahead.
Yeah.
I think things like the Fiat S76, the Beast of Turin, which is appears at Goodwood all the time now.
The big red thing with the rectangular exhaust holes on the side,
spitting flames and stuff. And that was, I think, one of those kind of projects. It's like, you know, you're working from photographs and hearsay from back in the day, and you kind of just have to do what you can. You've got some of the original bits, but some of them you have to make from scratch. And
you're effectively having to re-engineer it as they engineered it and go through the experience to figure out how it happened.
Yeah, and that kind of stuff's amazing, like how people do that and come up with these, recreate these amazing cars or rebuild these amazing cars from the period.
Yeah.
That's pretty special. And sometimes, they don't have the original people to speak to. I mean, a lot of the times, depending on how far back you go. So
you find that with, like, it always amazes me when you see, say, like a 250 GTO restoration, and they started with like chassis rails.
Yeah,
and it's like, this is all matching numbers. Like, how do you find that out? It's like, what book exists with all the chassis? And it's like, we have to go to this guy, and then he knows this guy, and he puts you in touch with this guy, and that guy's got a book with all the parts orders, so we know which parts were ordered and which numbers they had. And then that guy knows this guy who has another thing with all the engines that were put together. And you just go, oh, there's a whole rabbit hole of people that have the right bits.
Mm.
And your job is to find out who knows who and who's got what and recreate all of this. And to be fair, a 250 GTO like restoration is worth investing that time and energy into.
Yeah, and there's probably more experience around on those than for some other cars.
Yeah.
I mean, there are certainly those instances where, you know, a factory that these things were made in burnt down 70 years ago, and you think, well, okay, that's all the original plans gone, so now where do you start?
All the papers gone, everything.
Yeah,
I think especially like pre-war stuff as well, it must be almost impossible to find anything relevant for them, because A, they were built quite sporadically, and not in a R&D sense that we have today, where you have these stages, they go, right, we've got this steel, we're going to bend it a little bit, drill some holes into it, stick an engine on, see what happens. It's like, the flip side of this is it's almost impossible to verify whether you've done it right or wrong.
Yeah.
So no one can go, oh, you've done that wrong. It's like, well, if you know what it's supposed to be like, let us know, because we've been trying to figure it out.
There's a lot of certainly kind of building something to a spec as it was at a particular point in time, because the original builder of the car might have changed 8 times in the time that it was racing or whatever. And you can, as somebody rebuilding something like that today, you kind of just have to pick one.
Yeah, we're just, this is what we can manage.
Yeah.
At some point, it looked like this, so we're going with that. Yeah, it's such a rabbit hole, and it always makes my brain tired trying to think of how people do this, because you go, oh, how did they figure that out? And then you start thinking about the bits that you would have to do to try and do it, and you go, oh, this hurts too much, and nobody's paying me to do this, and it's not worth, I'm just wasting my own brain space right now. But yeah, it's just wild.
It's the nice thing about now being into 80s and 90s cars.
Which there's loads of stuff. Yeah, you can figure that one out.
And that kind of, again, as far as useful things about the internet go, that the ever-growing pool of knowledge on certain cars and things.
Yeah. The forums were just like, you could follow a specific car build from start to finish.
Yeah.
Because someone was making a forum thread on it, and they go, I've bought this car. And then every week they'd do different bits and they'd upload photos and that. And that's becoming a bit of a dying thing as well. People aren't utilising forums like they used to. And I, the episode that goes out before this is with Dave Edmondson and Mr. Pistonhead's creator, and effectively kind of started a bit of a revolution in how forums were. And that in itself has become a dying thing that seems to have just been a 2000s to, say, 2015 capsule.
Yeah.
Of look at all this wealth of information that exists, and then everyone moved to social media and it stopped because that was taking everyone's time. But speaking of 80s and 90s cars, you're quite a penchant for an old, interesting car.
Yeah, so that's definitely my era. I mean, those are the ones that I grew up reading about in magazines. And I mean, a huge part of my interest in cars was formed from that kind of peak video gaming era, and certainly towards the end of the 90s and start of the 2000s. The obvious one is Gran Turismo, but it came, I feel like I was just at the right age for all those things to make a real difference to what cars I'm interested in. And so, yeah, I've got two toys at the moment, both from the 90s. I've got a Peugeot 106 Rally Series 2 from 1998, which I bought probably coming up 7 years ago now, something like that. And then I've got a 1992 Mazda RX-7 third gen FD, one of the tiny handful of actual UK cars, which I bought from Mazda UK itself because it was on their heritage fleet. So it's the, basically, if you type in a Mazda RX-7, and a red FD comes up in a Google image search, it's probably mine because it's been in so many magazines, and so it's still in all their press images and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Have you ever been concerned about that car from how it's been driven being a former press car?
Not especially. I mean, I tend to, you know, press offices tend to look after stuff and they get maintained more regularly than other cars. Though I have had quite a journey with that thing because it's an older car, and it's an older car that was complicated even back in the day.
Yeah.
And it has done 96,000 miles or something, and it's that has aged it as well. So it's had the obligatory engine rebuild, and it's also had quite a lot of the underside kind of replaced.
I think when we'd met, you'd just got it back from having the underside sealed, didn't you?
Yeah, because it probably spent 4 months in sort of autumn 2022, having metalwork replaced and most of it being resprayed and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And that was, that was a nice expensive process. And it still, that car still needs finishing, kind of mechanically and stuff. But that was definitely a dream car purchase. I'd never seriously entertained back in the day the idea of owning one, and then it's one of those things where at a certain point it starts looking realistic.
Yeah.
And you think, actually, like everything else, the prices were going up.
I've written 12 BuzzFeed articles this week, I can afford it.
Yeah. This was when I was still gainfully employed, but it's it kind of, one came up at the right price at the right time, and that was one of those if not now then when sort of deals. And in retrospect, I probably would have been better just saving up and buying like a really perfect one from the start. But you never know that at the time. And so this was, I think actually when I bought it, I maybe had just gone freelance for the first time. And so it was a bit of a financial risk.
Yeah, because you're like, I'm going to step out onto my own. What should I do to make sure that my finances go? I buy a really old, unreliable car from Mazda. Brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, that was very much a purchase on a whim. I was actually on a Mazda event in Germany, right. And the PR man said that it was for sale, and I pretty much bought it on the spot. So.
Jeez, that's a brave move. That PR man's like, happy day. Oh my god, I've sold it. Yeah.
Well, the only reason they put it for sale was they had two. They had mine, and they had a very late. So they basically had the very first of the FDs and the very last of the FDs. So they had a Bathurst R. Which is an imported one, obviously. And they sold both of them to get a much lower miles early FD for the Heritage fleet.
That makes sense. Because I know if anyone's been watching what Mr. Harris has been up to, he's recently bought that M5 Touring V10 one and has found out that, A, he's driven it before and a few of his friends have driven it before because it was a press car.
Mm.
And he's gone on this discovery of, I drove that quite aggressively, and his mate was like, yeah, we took it to the Nürburgring and drove it really aggressively. He's now sat in this, oh god, I'm paying for my sins of mistreating a press car. And I think like any car event, especially over 20 years old now, you kind of have to just allow for things to crop up.
Yeah.
Like, even with my 2014 car, because it's done 125,000 miles, every journey I'm like, wonder what might happen soon now that it's at this mileage.
Yeah, you don't really. Yeah, I mean that's 10 years old now. You don't really think about that, but and my Mazda's now what's 32 years old, something like that.
Yeah.
And I would say more of the issues I've had with it have been from just its age, and general mileage and stuff than its duties as a press car.
Yeah.
People certainly I know from doing this myself, but. Journalists do treat the older stuff with a bit more reverence than maybe some of the newer cars.
Yeah.
So they don't get driven quite as hard. And allegedly, my RX-7, we think it was one of the original press cars from back in the day. Like, I've not actually gone back and looked at the prior registrations and stuff.
Right.
Because the one it's got on at the moment was more recent. But we think it's one of the original press cars because it's an incredibly early chassis number, and so it's probably first one across on the boat, and probably ended up in some magazines and stuff.
And it's in the red, and it's got all the hero marks for it.
Yeah, so it would have been, you know, back if it was a press car, it probably would have been driven quite hard back in the day because it was a brand new car at some stage.
It's like they treat them kindly now, but when they were new.
But then that was also two engines ago in this thing, so.
True, yeah. So the big problem's already been resolved anyway, hasn't it?
If any damage they did to the engine back in 1992, I'm two engines on from that then since.
I'm an engine in on the Toyota, and it still worries me. It's like it's already had one engine. It's only 10 years old. No, it's such an interesting car. And I think you were right with the Gran Turismo thing. So you're a little bit older than I am. So when I got Gran Turismo, I think I was about 7 or 8.
Mm.
So I didn't really have an appreciation for what it was. It was just, cars, I can drive them.
Yeah.
Whereas as an adult and playing on like Forza and stuff, you go, right, there's career progression and there's understanding what modifications do and tuning does and tweaking does and how cars feel and handle. And I'm guessing that came in at the point where you were kind of just able to understand that as a concept rather than me going, oh, cars, I'm going to drive a car and hopefully not crash.
Yeah, I mean, one of the mega things about Gran Turismo back in the day was that because the creator, Kazunori Yamauchi, was so serious about driving himself, he wanted, I mean, the series tagline is the real driving simulator, and he wanted this accurate behaviour and stuff. And so the manuals in the physical boxes for the thing had a bunch of details on like grip curves and gear ratios and all these very technical terms. And that was part of the joy of playing this game, is you could read through the manual and actually learn about not only whether the license tests and things in the game to try and make you better at it. But you could then go and read the manual and figure out why the car was behaving the way it was. And,
yeah, yeah.
And that was a weird, very specific thing to that genre of game and that era of game, I think.
You got to learn driving dynamics right from the source of the game producer, essentially.
Yeah, and then, yeah, and kind of, yeah, read about it and then kind of get a feel for what the car was doing and why it was doing that. And
yeah.
And it, the funny thing is you now go back and play, I've fairly recently replayed both the first two Gran Turismos, and obviously from a 2020s window, they've aged poorly in some ways. but they're still, you know, it's impressive that even back then they managed to get all the cars handling different, and
yeah.
The handling isn't necessarily that accurate by modern standards.
There was a notable difference between the cars.
Yeah. But Gran Turismo has been a blessing and a curse for me as well, because it has, because it's informed the kind of cars I'm into, it has given me this big long laundry list of cars that I want to own at some point, purely because they've been
there. They were in Gran Turismo, yeah.
But B, even how, like owning the FD, nothing in my head, it's never quite going to be the same as driving down like special stage route 5.
And yeah.
I've got this idea of like this kind of almost like underground racing scene in Japan in my head, and it's and you know, driving around Northamptonshire is never quite gonna.
There's no speedways around here.
No,
there's no like nighttime scene that makes it all cool. It's quite bland.
Yeah.
To look at.
So I've got
some
I've
nice
got
roads,
the right car,
but...
yeah. So I've got the right car, but not the right life for it. I would say.
Yeah, yeah. You need to take it over to Tokyo for a couple of weeks and try and find the right route. I mean, you could always go over and do the rentals up in the mountains.
Mm, yeah, I mean that has obviously caught my eye. There's a few of those companies which hire out some quite cool stuff.
Yeah.
And that's definitely on the sort of bucket list for some stage. Much of the RX-7 is great, it's not a keeper. I will eventually buy something more sensible, I think.
Yeah.
But once it's sorted, that is the idea behind that is kind of get it to a point where I can road trip it and maybe do a few track days, and then that'll I'll tick the box with that one.
Well, we're fortunate that Northamptonshire does contain Silverstone, and that is on most of the, like, I can go and spend an hour on my Xbox driving a GT86 around Silverstone, and then within an hour I could be at Silverstone driving my GT86. Like, we're quite fortunate that some of the stuff that made it into the games does exist around here.
Mm.
Just some of the very specific things that we want. Like, Maple Valley Speedway, never going to happen. Never going to be able to take any car around Maple Valley Speedway, because it doesn't exist, does it?
No.
That was a completely made-up one for Forza. And it's like, that's one of my favourite tracks. Like, I remember in my teenage years, I was obsessed with trying to beat the online track lap record.
Mm.
And I just spent hour after hour trying to shave seconds and milliseconds off to try and get closer. It turned out I was using the wrong car. It was impossible to get faster in the car that I was using. But that is like an ingrained memory of Maple Valley Speedway is the one that I can go quickly at. And now it's, fortunately, I've gotten quite good at Spa.
Mm.
So it could happen one day that I take a car around Spa at speed. But yeah, you're completely right that it's almost impossible to relive those childhood memories in reality without being a multimillionaire.
It was, yeah, the games made it very easy to kind of build up in your head how life with one of those cars would be like.
yeah.
And then it's almost like the reality is never going to live up to it.
Well, Gran Turismo doesn't have a under-sealing and rewelding the panels of your car simulator.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of, obviously as an adult, I knew what I was getting into when I bought an RX-7, but as a kid, you don't imagine that living with an RX-7 mostly means it's stuck in a garage or being repaired or having rust swapped out of it.
Yeah.
Or staring in abject horror at the most recent fuel bill or any of those sort of things. So.
No, it's all about you just turn up and the car's ready and off you go.
Yeah.
Which for some people is how life is. Well, but for the vast majority of us, it's not like that. And if anyone's ever tried to get into motorsport and you realise just how expensive it is just to go...
Mm.
In any proper capacity, like track days are a different thing, but going and doing actual motorsport is just a mountain of cash required to do it properly.
Yeah, well, even track days are getting expensive now as well. I mean, for what you get and for the kind of the getting to spend a few hours on a track and driving as you wouldn't be able to on the road is obviously a privilege. But it's something that you can't necessarily do regularly because it is, does get quite expensive.
Yeah. I think the closest thing I've seen to almost affordable is sprint days.
Yeah. Yeah.
They seem to be the way to actually go and spend some time pushing your car and learning how to drive properly and being able to kind of go to different tracks and experience different venues. That seems to be the approach for most people that actually want to do it to some degree.
Yeah. And they're not super hard on the car as well. Like, it's one of the things, I've taken the rally on a couple of hill climbs and, you know, in some respects, driving as fast as possible up a hill sounds like it's quite an abusive thing to do, but ultimately
you're not braking.
Yeah, but you're not using the brakes as much. And I like the Haggerty one at
Shelsley.
Shelsley.
Yeah.
You're talking a time of under a minute to get up the hill or whatever it is. Is it under a minute or is that just the really fast ones?
I think under a minute. You're going quite quick to get under. Because I think I got the 86 up there in about a minute.
Right. Okay.
And
yeah.
And Shelsley commented going, "That's really fast." I was like, oh, I might be misremembering this.
Yeah, I was certainly slower than you. But whatever the time was, like, you know, it's, you do three or four runs in the day and they're all, you know,
they're about an hour apart, aren't
they? I was gonna say, and total time doing that is probably less than 5 minutes. And actually that's not too bad on a car.
It's like, a fantastic day as well. Because not you, because of your doing five runs, you can have 100 people there. So you get 100 different cars doing 100 different styles and runs and this, that, and the other. Like, the Haggerty Hill Climb is a really good one. And this isn't trying to plug Haggerty, as much as they are quite good pals. That is quite a nice event because it's so diverse and broad.
Yeah.
And I think Shelsley do quite a lot of that sort of stuff now where they go, right, we'll just have, like, Horsepower Hill for the day and we'll just bring whatever's got a load of horsepower and see which one's the fastest up the hill. And it makes for a nice bit of motorsport because it's got a bit of diversity. Like, as much fun as the MX-5 Cup is... Watching it online is probably better than watching it in person because you get a real sense for who's doing what and you can see every corner and what's going on.
Yeah.
And if you try and photograph the MX-5 Cup, it's a day spent photographing the same 20 MX-5s.
Yeah.
You know, unless one of these teams really wants me to take photos for them, I'm not getting as much value as, say, the Pomeroy Trophy, where you've got a pre-war Bentley and a brand new Bentley both on track at the same time.
Yeah.
Because that's how the competition works. But in terms of, like, where things are going then, obviously the RX-7's not a permanent fixture in your life, and being freelance, things are always quite fluid in which direction things are heading. What's the future looking like?
That's a very interesting question because freelancing does have kind of like this up and down thing where some months it can look quite lean and then other months it's much better. And I do have these moments of wondering whether, you know, I've potentially got another 30 years of career ahead of me, whether I want to spend the next 30 years looking for work every month, because that's quite a commitment. But so I tend to focus a bit more on the immediate future at the moment, and that just means trying to do the work I'm doing, try and think of interesting things for the future, and then keeping my motley crew of cars alive. And also the permanent thing, which all kind of car people have, which is wondering what to get next.
Yeah.
So I've got a few ideas of that, most of which involve selling everything and pumping a bit more money into something kind of even nicer. So
a bit of what Mr. Goy does, and just have an Aston Martin and a Morgan. I spent all my money, and these two cars exist, and that's about it.
Well, I think one of the dreams, again, like probably a lot of people have, is to try and find that one car that you can kind of keep forever.
Yeah.
And that's always tricky because certainly if you... I always think I'm slightly envious of people who have found their thing. Mm. Like, there are people out there who they have an MGB and they've owned it for 30 years and that's they're happy to own it for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
And that's all they ever care about. But if you're the sort of car enthusiast who likes all cars, makes choosing the next one incredibly difficult because there are umpteen different things which you could potentially get.
Yeah, and it's not like you can go, oh, which is the best driving experience, because you get such a variety in that answer as well.
Yeah.
It's like the Toyota for me ticks so many boxes, but I'm not sure if it's the car that I'd be like, well, this is it, I'm happy with this. Like, I'm always like, I wish I had more power.
Yeah.
Or like, I wish I had a turbo, or like, I wish it had this dynamic difference or that dynamic difference. I love that car and I've not got plans to get rid of it, but I have got plans to have something out.
Yeah.
And that would, because it's become so synonymous with what I'm up to, it's quite hard to go, well, I'll just get rid of that and get something else. And like, I'd probably miss it quite a lot.
Yeah.
It holds quite a lot of sentimental value more than it does, oh, I want to keep this car forever because I like it as a driving experience. It's more, I want to keep this car for a long time because it's so connected to me as a person, and the journey that I've been through has been with that car.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, I'd quite like an M2 because that's a bit more power but still has enough space to get stuff in it, and it's got a different driving experience, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, but I'd also like something mid-engined. I'd also like something four-wheel drive. Or like, I'd also like something really fast and light and front-wheel drive. And you just end up going, I need a 20-car garage.
Yeah, well, space is the big thing, isn't it? Because there are, I don't even have particularly expensive tastes. Like, there's a couple of things which are worth a bit of money, which I would like to eventually get. But, you know, I could be happy for the rest of my life on cars that cost $3,000.
Yeah.
But I've only ever got a couple of parking spaces at any given time, and stuff has to stick around until I feel like I've used it, and then that is out the door, and then the next one comes in. So
yeah, yeah.
That is the tricky thing, is unless you do have loads of space, actually finding just the room to stick all these things that you're interested in.
No, it's a big conundrum, and then you end up going, well, how much is it to rent a unit?
Yeah.
And then how many cars can I get in there? How do I make this viable? And then you end up to the podcast that came out recently with John Hancock. He's got a big unit, but he builds cars.
Right.
So it kind of justifies the unit, and it stops his wife from being like, you've just got a big car park here out in the countryside that you just spend money on. He goes, no, that's earning money, and that earns money, and it justifies it all.
The risk with that, though, is that kind of space. Like, I know people who kind of, yeah, use their garage for something. And the risk is then filling space with kind of useless ornaments, which could be useful space for your business.
Yeah, true, yeah.
So yeah, that's the tricky thing. Is everybody has their limit. Like, is that thing of the ideal number of cars is
one more
n plus
have.
One.
Yeah, yeah. It's the joys of being a car enthusiast is that you're always going to be in this conundrum. And I think it goes all the way to it. It doesn't matter how much money you have, you will always want something else.
Yeah.
Like, I know someone that's got multiple millions of pounds worth of cars, like including like Derek Bell's McLaren that he raced in Le Mans and stuff like that level of car.
Yeah.
And it's forever changing. There's always something coming and something going, and there's never enough space, and there's always something more to add. So it's just part of being a car enthusiast.
Well, one of the biggest joys for me of being a car enthusiast is that you can kind of indulge in it all the time, every day, because even when you're just commuting or going to the shops or something, cars are everywhere, and you kind of get to appreciate things on a constant basis, which you couldn't if your thing was climbing mountains. You can kind of only do that sometimes.
Like, yeah, yeah.
Most of the time you're stuck in an apartment somewhere. You're not climbing mountains. But if I'm into cars, then just going to the shops is an opportunity to experience the thing that I'm into.
I've spotted two phaetons in this village this week, and it's made me enormously excited. I'm like, I just walked to the co-op and spotted a phaeton, and it made my day.
Yeah.
Like, you don't get that unless you're a helicopter enthusiast and you live near an airbase.
Yeah.
You're not going to get that every day. And we get quite a range of military aircraft come over here because we're within flight paths and things like that. And I'm now going, I find that really interesting. And I've started developing a bit of a, oh, what was that? And I've downloaded the flight tracker app on my phone and this, that, and the other. And my other half started laughing at me. She went, we've lived here for a few months. She's like, you've already downloaded the flight tracker app. Whenever something flies over, you're immediately like, oh, what was that? She's like, this is turning into another hobby, isn't it? I'm like, well, I can't afford any of the planes, so no. This is as far as it can go. So now it's also turned into birds, because we're in the countryside. So you get, I went for a walk, and my other half was in Milton Keynes with her friends. I was like, I've just spotted a buzzard, and took a video, because I was like, this is what a buzzard sounds like. So when we're next out on a walk, I remember what it sounds like. It's like, oh, I've hit 30, and this is all starting to happen. Like, I'm just becoming a nerd for just like bird watching apparently just creeps up on you.
Yeah, oh yeah.
You find stuff interesting, you go for a drive and go, that looks like a red kite because it's got this split in its tail. And you're like, oh no, bird watching, it's happening.
Yeah, your 30s is random pains and unexpected hobbies, I think.
Yeah, and bird watching's crept up. So I got a kid's binocular set for Christmas as a bit of a joke. And now I'm like, well, I've got a 200 mil lens for my camera, so I can actually take some photos of things that are far away. And then I was out on a walk the other day and an Emirates plane flew over me, but I had my camera. So I took a photo of it, and then a buzzard flew over me, and I took a photo of that. And I got home and I was like, I've managed to spot these today. And Grace is like, it's happening, it's getting you. She went, they're really good photos, but it's not cars, is it? That's what you got the camera for. So yeah, and with the random pain thing, every so often my wrist here, that just hurts. Just every so often I can't move my hand to the left. I have no idea why. So I've just decided that I need to start wearing my watch looser, see if that helps.
For me, it's waking up with a hangover even if I've not been drinking.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
That same feeling. It's like, that's unfair.
I've started being able to get a hangover on one pint. Didn't know that was going to come. I've never been a big drinker, but in my 20s, you can have a few drinks and still go to work the next day without feeling it. Now I can have one pint and not have dinner.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, geez, where's this come from? Like, what's happening? And I've got enough weight now to be able to soak through that, and it's still getting me. But this is the joy. Like, one thing I try and keep with everything that I'm doing, I try and be as authentic as I can. And hopefully this sort of conversation keeps that authenticity there. Like, I'm really conscious that a lot of the stuff that we see these days is quite manufactured.
Mm.
And hopefully people appreciate just a little bit of authenticity
whilst
not being stupid with it. Like, there's being authentic and being mature about being authentic, and there's being authentic and just being an idiot, bumbling around being an idiot. And I hope that it leans a little bit more to the, it's authentic, but it's not stupid.
Yeah.
Because then you end up with reality TV, and I'm not in any way trying to be a Kardashian. And there's a guy that's become really big on social media recently for like eating fish and chips or something. But it's the, like, there's loads of drama. But it's the most, like, council estate drama you've ever seen. And it's got this huge audience. And I had no idea any of this existed. And I happened upon one video of, oh, so-and-so's girlfriend's been seen with so-and-so and this, that, and the other. And I was like, this is, like, public council house drama. And this isn't me trying to be derogatory to people in council estates or anything like that. But it's if you were to just, like, Shameless, it fits that model really well. I was like, this is the world now. Like, that sort of stuff is publicly happening in the same way that the Kardashians exist. This guy's got a gold chain with his name on it. He's doing club appearances on like student union bars and stuff like that. And everyone's going, but what does he do? It's like, nothing. He's a reality TV star. That's what's happened. And I hope that I don't fall into that when I sit down and have chats with people and go, my wrist hurts now. It's just part of growing up. So rather than try and wander down too much of a tangent into this is what it's like when you turn 30, because I think most of the people that listen to this are older than me.
Yeah, probably now already.
And they're all like, yes, you child, keep up. Like, it's coming for you. And I'm just blissfully ignorant at this point. It's been an absolute pleasure to actually sit down and chat, because we do cross paths quite a lot. And I feel like you and I don't often get enough time to actually be mates. And it's quite annoying, because I think we spend quite a lot of time at the same stuff, or talking about the same stuff, or doing stuff in the same sphere. And it's annoying that we live reasonably close and we still don't actually get a chance to sit down and chat. So if nothing else, it's been really nice to catch up.
Yeah, likewise. Yeah, it's been fun.
I'm just going to say thank you for sitting down and chatting. And if people want to reach out to you to give you work, where's the best place to do it?
I mean, amazingly, it's still Twitter, I think, really, where I am, Anthony Wrights, AntonyWrites.
That's Anthony without the H.
Yep, correct.
Just for clarity, because I naturally go with the H and then have to correct myself. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'll stop it there. And there we are. Firstly, thank you for listening all the way through. If you're hearing this, it means that you've made it to the end. And secondly, if you or people that are close to you are needing a bit of extra support, if you go to the Tacona website, there's a page on there full of mental health services and resources, things like phone numbers and websites that are for dedicated support. They are to be used. Don't think that you can only use them as a last effort. Use them if you need them now. Other than that, thank you so much for having a listen. Thank you for being part of the conversation. And hopefully it's encouraged you to talk to other people a bit more. Thank you.